podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Cheeseman Podcast. This is Brendan, your host for the show. Very special show for you today. We're delighted to be joined once again by South American football expert and friend of the show, Tim Vickery. Tim, how are you doing?
Yeah, very well. Lovely to be here. And I'm looking forward to kicking a ball around and learning a few things over the next few minutes.
The thing is, I feel bad also limiting you to South America. You're just a general sort of football expert. So do you mind being sort of restricted to South America in these tags?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, I never imagined that I would ever kind of make a proper living out of this. So if that's what it's taken, that's perfect. And obviously, you know, South American players, they get all over the place. So, you know, some of my tentacles even extend to London N17.
Also joined by Mr. Paul Muir. How you doing, Paul?
All right, mate. Yeah, I'm good. I'm like, guys, I'm with Phil. I'm looking forward to like having a chat. Be nice.
You mean Tim, not Phil?
I really don't mind Phil. You know,
I really
don't mind it. I don't mind it. I would just like that. I think there's two Phils, isn't there? One's a rugby player, and one's a celebrity chef.
Just once in their lives.
I'd like one of them to be called Tim. Just once, and I'd be happy with that. But I'll answer to anything. I'm not proud.
I'm going to call you Mr. V from now on.
I'm going to call you Frank. Frank. Yeah. I'm going to call your bluff.
Oh, fantastic.
Sorry about that.
So, Tim, last time we had you on, I think we were talking about the club announcement with the ticketing price increases. And we spoke a bit about Ange. How are you feeling now? Like, we're towards the end, nearly at the end of his first season. Still happy, still enjoying Ange ball? Any question marks?
I'm very, very happy. Very happy. I remember my position at the start of the season was, I would honestly be happy with eighth place as long as there was an attempt to recapture our identity. And I think that this has more than happened. So I'm extremely happy with the way that things have gone. I have to confess, and here I want to learn from the pair of you, that I've been a little bit out of the loop recently. And as you'll know, Brent, this is a moment in South American football where there's just too much going on. Mm. There's so much going on with our Champions League, the Libertadores starting, the FIFA dates, the Brazilian Championship. There's just been so much going on that I've been a little bit out of the loop. So in the opinion of you fine gentlemen, has anything happened over recent months that makes you question the season, or are you as happy as I am?
I sat through Conte ball and I sat through Mourinho ball for the last couple of seasons. I am overjoyed, like also Mr. Vickery, to see like what we're playing at the moment. I thought anywhere within kind of fourth to seventh or eighth would be a good season. I think a lot of people got carried away at the beginning with the first 10-11 games. Obviously, it's a new style of football. We were searching around for identity. We were searching around for some kind of style of play after what Conte and Stellini for a few games, and then Mason, obviously, at the back end of last season. We've got that now. It's come a little bit unravelled with a few different pieces. Like, we've not been found out. We've just stumbled a little bit. So I don't really agree with that narrative. What's going on at the moment? It's like Ange ball's been found out. We need some better players to execute his game plan. But I am absolutely overjoyed with some of the stuff we've played. Yeah, there's been some hard watches and there's been some tough games, especially, you know, with the injuries and everything like that. But I think we are definitely making. On and off the pitch with some of the new technical staff and the backroom staff and the directors of football and people like this, I think we're definitely going in the right direction. And compared to where we were this time last season, it's chalk and cheese, in my opinion.
I think probably the first thing that we all thought right at the start of the season was, wow, there are going to be days when this goes badly wrong. Yeah. You know, because it's a very, very bold approach. And the question always with this is, what happens then? After it goes badly wrong, is there a loss of belief? And so far, I don't think that has happened at all. I am concerned about the game on Sunday, because if it goes badly wrong in that one, that's a big thing. That will be tough to assimilate. What do you reckon, Frank?
What do I think? I think the fans held their nerve. And I think Dejan Kulusevski said this about in the piece he did after the Chelsea game, where we got two players sent off. Maddison hobbled off a bad knee as well. Sorry, bad ankle in that game. And we went down to 9 men. And we still played the way we want to play. I was expecting the crowd to... I was at the game. It was obviously at home. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing from the crowd and the people around me. We're very easy to boo. We're very easy to like go negative quite quickly as a fan base. Certainly what we've seen over the last couple of seasons. But we held our nerve as a fan base and we applauded. And we could see what Angie's trying to do. We could see that the guys are trying and they're doing the basics professionally. They're trying to win their duels. They're trying to play the way that the coach wanted them to play. And Eric Dier, 5 millimetres the other way, would have won it. Millimeters offside. That was the game when I thought, this is the guy for us. And I think he's built up enough credit at the minute to see us through over these little kind of bumps. That's what I think.
Just looking at the big picture, Tim, in terms of where we will finish in the league, obviously now fifth place doesn't get Champions League after what happened. It was quite fun to see the Goons knocked out, but then City went, Liverpool got knocked out of Europa and West Ham knocked out of Europa as well. And so it's fifth isn't going to get Champions League. Are you okay with Europa? The thing is, for me as well, it seems a bit more like a competition that we can actually win. And we spoke about this yesterday in the preview, but that it is quite hard for British teams to win the Europa League, bearing in mind the schedule and that there's not as much support from the Premier League in terms of scheduling the teams in it. But we can win that. We can win that competition. We can rotate during the group stage. And it'd be great to see us lift that trophy.
Yeah, and it is a tough one, this, isn't it? Because the Champions League, it's not only the money you get as a consequence. It's also how that helps you attract players. Mm. It's big in that sense. But if you look at it, I don't think we're anywhere near ready for the Champions League yet. I mean, I think Arsenal is a perfect example. I mean, you have to say it. Really, really impressive in the Premier League this season. Really, really impressive. But in the Champions League, it's been different. You know, they struggled against Porto and they struggled against Bayern, and they struggled to create in those games. It's a different thing. It's a different level, and I don't think we're anywhere near that yet. So I can see the pros of the Champions League in terms of this makes it easier to attract players. But Newcastle is another example, isn't it? Mm. This season, how much harder they found it to fight on a number of fronts. So if it is Europa League, I won't think that's a disaster at all. Although I'm not sure that we'd win that either. Mm-hmm. I think maybe because you got to sustain it through the season, and a bad 90 minutes in April. You know, look what happened to Liverpool, who are a better side than we are at the moment. So I think that sometimes we think that Europa League is much easier to win than it actually is. So I don't know. I put all those things together and I emerge confused. If we do get the fourth place, well, that makes us more attractive to the world's leading players. Possibly that would be for the better, because for the moment, I don't see us winning either the Europa League.
Mm-hmm. Paul, are you at peace with Europa? If it does, I mean, like I said, it's quite doom and gloom to assume that we're going to finish fifth. We can finish fourth still. We've got two games in hand on Villa. We'll be three after Saturday. but just if they do win against Chelsea, that's a 9-point gap, and it just starts to look a bit shaky.
Yeah, it's a tough hill to climb at that point, to summit that. I'm with Tim. I don't think the squad's anywhere near deep enough. I think 1 to 11, when we sort out our midfield, I think we could probably, you know, do quite well in the group stages. But it's obviously if one of those players, two of those players gets injured, we don't have the quality of backup. It would need a fire sale of like 6 or 8 players going out this summer, and then maybe 5 or 6 of equal quality or better quality than we've got already to come in and even make us like competitive. So I don't think that's going to happen, to be honest. So I'm fine with Europa League. I worry about playing, you know, like 2 games a week, sometimes 3 games a week, you know, but that's just the workload of a modern footballer or a modern elite football team, excuse me. So I'm fine with Europa. I really am. I think, you know, we could see that there are some difficult ties. It does create, especially with a new format, trying to work it out the other day, it seems quite convoluted. But to answer your question, no, I don't. We're not ready for, we're nowhere near ready for Champions League. I think Europa League, I'd be happy with next season.
Yeah. We got Champions League under Conte, and we stank the place out. Like, we were terrible. Like, I went to the Sporting Lisbon game with Sandro, and it was terrible.
Oh, did you? You've not mentioned that before. did you guys?
Sorry. I had to name Jota today. He's going to be at the Goons game. So keep an eye out for him, Paul.
I believe it. Didn't he? He made his debut. League Cup game. Just by coincidence, I was there. I had a chat with him afterwards, and we got hammered in that game as well. You know,
because he was 0-0 at full time, and he was like, "Yes, 0-0." He's like, "That you go back out." And he's like, "Oh shit!" He didn't quite know the format. He told me the story of that game. Yeah, it was, they did spank us after extra time. Yeah,
4-1, 21st September 2010.
Tim, I don't know if you, I'm sure you did see actually the news today about Sweden, that they have decided to fully drop VAR altogether. I listened to obviously the Brazilian Surname podcast, the World Football Phone, and I know your feelings on VAR. Do you think that there is a chance that the Premier League will pull away or adapt at least with VAR?
I don't think we're going to get rid of it. Because when I'm not a fan, although there are situations where errors are so glaring, you know, and it's so unfair on the referee that he gets one look. I'm honestly astonished quite often at how good the assistants are with offsides. I'm astonished by it. Much better. Well, when I was a kid, they were terrible. Often they weren't specialists. They were referees as well. They were awful. Now I think they're much, much better. But there are cases where it does seem incongruous that everyone in the stadium who's got a mobile phone can see something, and the one person out there in the middle who has to make the decision can't see it. So I think it's going to be hard to get rid of. But I think it's undeniable that it hasn't achieved what its advocates said it was going to achieve. You know, because the idea was it was going to do away with controversy. It has just created another forum for controversy. And so many of the decisions in football are subjective, their interpretation. Science cannot answer these adequately. And as a TV technician told me this years ago, offside is what offside. You are not getting a scientific thing on offside. You're not. It depends so much on the exact moment that the camera is frozen, and all of this, I think, is outside the spirit of the law. Now, offside, you have to be seeking to gain an advantage. So if I like the old conception of if you're level, you're on. And I think that worked better. So with VAR, number one, it hasn't stopped controversy. It's created another forum for controversy. And number two, it's worsened the spectacle. And so it hasn't been a success. But I don't think we're going to get rid of it because, as I said, of those glaring errors. We're going to have to find a way to adapt to this, I fear. Mm. I would happily get rid of it.
Yeah.
But then you have to accept that mistakes are going to be made. So I would happily get rid of it, but I don't think big time football is going to do that. I would like to see it used as little as possible. For the most glaring things and nothing else.
Is it not a positive move, the change in the system for the offsides? It is going to be the semi-automated system that FIFA used at the World Cup, which was noticeably quicker. So at least the spectacle side of it.
That advantage in speed is good, but still you're left with the problem that you are interpreting a law not in the way that it was originally meant to be interpreted. You are bringing a level of scientific exactitude, if you can do it, to something that wasn't meant for scientific exactitude. Mm-hmm. It was meant for that thing, if you are in front, if you are seeking to gain an advantage. So if it is, I mean, some of the goals get ruled out for the most ludicrous motives. And this seems to me to be the opposite of what you want. To cultivate a spectacle, and that moment when the ball goes in, you know, to anything that dilutes that moment for me is questionable, and there really, really has to be. If you're going to dilute that moment when the ball goes in, then there's got to be a very, very good reason, far better than a toenail being offside.
Mm. Case in point, the Coventry goal. That was, and the thing is as well, it wasn't Tim was saying about exact science. It's still inconclusive. It still doesn't look, because again, it's like Tim says, it depends when the ball leaves the player's foot, and the lines were, it didn't look conclusive in any way that was offside, and that was a huge moment in FA Cup history. That would have been probably the greatest moment in FA Cup history, ruined by a technology that is not perfect.
It slows everything. You're sitting in the stadium, you're seeing it, you know, and it's not cheap sitting where I sit, right? And you immediately, when a goal goes in, like Werner sprints through, Son sprints through, Johnson sprints through onto a through ball from Pape Matar Sarr. Immediately, like, we score. You're not, now there is, as Phil
not
said
again.
there
not
is...
Again.
I did it on purpose.
Okay, sorry.
As Tim said there, you don't want to lose that moment.
We're going to have to talk about Belize in a minute. I can feel it coming on.
You don't want like 60,000 people like all looking at the linesman or all looking up at a video monitor. It's mad, because now we're getting to that point now where it's almost like the immediate thing is like, you look up at the screen and you want the instant kind of like the confirmation yourself that VAR aren't going to spoil your moment. And it just takes away from that euphoric moment. And and some of the checks take so long. You just stand in it, because you can't, it's not like rugby where they show it on the big screen and you see what the TMO is seeing in rugby. You're just standing there in the stadium. You don't know what's going on. And sometimes it's like 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and you've got like Andy Madlett just standing there like with his finger to his ear, kind of like, all right, so VAR. And you might as well just get your phone out and like just go on the Wi-Fi in a stadium and look on Sky or BT or whatever it is now, Discovery over here, and just like check it, because you'll learn more looking at a TV screen than the thing 15 meters that you're paying so much money to see. It's ludicrous.
It turns you into TV audience. That's what it does. It's wrong.
It makes you more. It just makes you more automated. It's just like, okay, so we'll just be fed this thing from a guy in a porter cabin in Stockley Park. It's taken away, as Vickery said, it's taken away from the spectacle, and you can't allow that. You can't allow it, because this is a product that we're selling worldwide for millions and billions of pounds, you know, and we're still getting it wrong. Goal line technology obviously works, you know, that's 99.9% correct. Okay, that's fine. I'm also with Mr. Vickery saying about, like, I'm astonished at how the linesmen keep up with the play. They're athletes, 50 meters, like shuttles backs and forwards, keeping up with like some of our wide players, Brennan Johnson, Timo Werner, Heung-min Son. You know, they're quick players and they get it right a lot of the time. So I'm in favour of getting rid of it, to be honest. Yeah. I am, and that's somebody who wants the game to evolve. I do want it to evolve, and I don't want it to be so much controversy, but it's now coming to the point now where refs are scared shitless to make a decision as well, because they can just go at the VAR and back it up. It's just get rid of it. Sorry, I ranted there a little bit. Excuse me.
The thing is, we saw there's various opinions about that Nottingham Forest tweet. It made them look a bit cheap. It made them look a bit like a fan. It was like a fan. It was as if their Twitter handle had been taken over by a fan. You will get these people bringing into question integrity, and that's wrong. And the people all running it aren't corrupt. They're not. There's no conspiracy. There's all this talk and with social media as well. Everyone's sort of this scandalous sort of like, oh, we've been wronged, and this is an outrage, and replay the game and all this.
Brent, Tim, what remember when like the Liverpool goal through VAR? Like, what was the feeling over there about that? Well, I mean, was there any kind of like was there any kind of like, oh, VAR is wrong, or was it just like, oh, the Premier League has just fucked it up again? Was there any kind of like, was there any waves made about that bad decision?
I was in Colombia, so, and my Spanish is shit, right, so I wasn't able to...
Okay.
Tim?
All right.
Brazil loves technology. Right. So there is some pushback against it, but nothing like as much as you're getting in some other countries. It was seen by many as, look, the Premier League have got VAR wrong. They're doing it wrong. Right. But there aren't many who question the fact that VAR exists. Okay. I think maybe some more of them. I'm interested to see. I mean, I was on TV today and I really wanted to talk about Sweden, but we didn't. we never got around to it. There's so much football going on. We never got around to it. But for a long time, it was just seen, the idea of being anti-VAR was like outside the window of possibility. You know, it was just seen as loot. I think it's now seen as possible. It is a position that people can take. But still, I think most are largely in favour.
Mm.
Although, as fans, almost everyone believes that the whole system is bent against their team. But that's the part of the fan experience, which is why I agree with you. It's so dangerous what Forest do when they try and take that to the official position of the club. Because then you start attacking the integrity of everything. And the vital thing about football is, look, mistakes are going to be made.
Mm.
You just get on with the game. All right, you try and improve the refereeing and so on. But if you take the field or take the stadium thinking that the referee, you know, honestly believing that the whole thing is bent against you, you might as well not bother. Mm.
It's just another indirect kind of pressure applied, not by a manager. For example, Klopp after the Tottenham Spurs game, where they wanted a written explanation and a written this and a written that from the PGMOL. That's just trying to like basically pressure a ref in your next two or three games to make such a media furore about it that you'll get a decision in the next two or three games, isn't it? And I think Forrest's tweet has now escalated. It's taken that pressure. One, you cannot, from an official point of view, put pressure on the officiating of a game. Because you do. Yeah, you call everything. Yeah, it's like, you know, and it's almost like somebody on work experience has got hold of like the Greek magnate's phone and decided, right, okay, like let's do a tweet. It was so ill thought out. It was horrendous. Mm. And you can't do that. You can't apply such obvious kind of like overt pressure on the officiating of the game from an official club point of view. You can't do that. That's a step too far. That's taking what Klopp and Ferguson and Wenger and all those guys were doing, and then taking it further, in my opinion.
Well, let's move on to our South American players. We've Tim, as you know, we got sort of a good sort of spine of Coutinho, Romero, Bentancur, Richarlison are playing quite regularly. Emerson Royale probably will move on during the summer. But what have you made so far of our LATAM contingent? Who stood out most for you? Is it Cuti?
Yeah, Romero. Yes, I mean, I think he's a front forward centre back, isn't he? Which was why I think it was such a waste of him the way that we were playing under Conte, and he did that very, very well with Atlanta. You know, a front forward team. I remember being in the stadium, October against Fulham, and it was just before all the suspensions and the injury problems. and you're looking at the pair of the centre backs and thinking, blimey, they're good. Yeah. They are really, really good, but they're walking on a high wire. You wonder what's going to happen if they lose form, get suspended or get injured. Well, we found that out, didn't we? So Romero, for me, there will always be excesses to his game.
Mm.
It's part of who he is. It's part of his interpretation of the role of centre-back. He wants to win the physical battle. He wants to impose himself. I remember one of his early games when he got bullied by Antonio of West Ham. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Thinking, wow, how's he getting? He's reacted to that really, really well. And so for me, he's the most important of them. Emerson Royale seems like a lovely fella.
Yeah.
But I didn't understand why we bought him, especially the Conte thing where the system is so dependent on your wing backs and he just wasn't good enough to do it. You know, he's filled in gamely in a number of different positions, and he's always tried his best, but I don't think he's quite good enough. Who else? Bentancur this season is not quite a write-off, but almost, isn't it? You know, he's missed so much from injury. Hopefully we can get him back and flying next year. Lo Celso is the one who fascinates me because and he is one of the leading analysts in Argentina, Diego Latorre. He was one of the Maradonas who wasn't. You know, he had an all right career, but he was a great analyst. And when Lo Celso was playing really well for us a few months back, he was saying he's a genius. His appreciation of the pass and the space, him and Messi together for the Argentine national team are brilliant. He's just on the same wavelength. Physically, I think the Premier League is a struggle for him, and it's also a struggle to keep fit. You know, that makes you think, is he ever going to be fit enough to do it week in, week out? But I love watching him when he's on song. And Richarlison, you get service into the box, and he's not going to hide, and he's going to attack it. He doesn't give you a great deal else. And he was another one. I just couldn't understand why we bought him. Couldn't understand it. Couldn't understand where he was going to fit in to a side that had Kane and Son. Couldn't understand it. Obviously now Kane has gone, and you can play him right up there as the number nine. And you look at his goal record, certainly for Brazil, it's excellent. Mm. It's really good. Got on the same wavelength as Neymar, got on the same wavelength as Paquetá. He had them making the bullets for him to fire, and he could fire them. And he'll miss three, and he'll still have a go at the fourth. And that's important. So I do like him, although I think we could probably do better in that position.
Do you think
it's a tough position? There aren't that many out there. Really good centre forward penalty area performers around, and I like him very much. I think he's very good, but I think he's world class.
Yeah, that's the difficulty. I mean, we spoke about this on the pod actually, and Paul asked me when he gave those interviews with ESPN about the mental health struggles that he had. How, because I answered as best I could, but you're certainly the best person to ask this. How heavy does the Brazil number nine shirt weigh on players? So after the Brazil were knocked out of the World Cup in really, really tough fashion, he did demonstrate, he did speak about the struggles that he had, and he had people that were close to him that betrayed him, and he did speak about suicide. That was, as we saw with Dele as well. How has it been reported in Brazil? I gave as much of an answer as I could, but you're
yeah. Well, that number nine thing is an interesting observation because unfortunately, I'm going to have to take this one down the other end of the Seven Sisters Road. And Gabriel Jesus went into the World Cup Russia 2018 as the man, as the solution for the centre forward position, and his goal scoring record was fantastic. He went through that World Cup and didn't score a single goal in a side that was attacking, an attractive attacking side, and he's never recovered from it. That continues to be a trauma for Gabriel Jesus, that 2018 World Cup. He's hardly scored for Brazil since. In fact, he scored one goal in 5 years for Brazil, which came in, and he's played lots. And that came in stoppage time of a friendly against South Korea that they were already winning 4-1. You know, it's not a particularly important goal. Yeah. And, you know, he wanted to run away from the number nine. He didn't want to play as a number nine anymore, you know. So that was all because of what happened in that World Cup in Russia. You know, it's a huge thing. It's a huge thing. And Richarlison says, you know, when he's out there training, he imagines he's playing against Argentina in a World Cup. So yeah, it's a big thing. But obviously, in his case, there are other things as well. You do wonder a little bit if he's really born for export.
How do you mean?
You wonder if living abroad isn't, because living abroad, as you'll know, Brent, it's not for everyone.
Mm.
I've never spoken to him. But you wonder with him if, in a perfect world for him, he would still be in Brazil.
I know. I'm just through Sandro. Like when he was at Watford, that Herrera Gomes was the daddy for Brazilians. Any Brazilian that was playing in London,
yeah.
Herrera Gomes was the go-to guy. They'd do barbecues, play music. So he had that sort of reminder of home. He had that sort of comfort of familiarity with other Brazilians, not just for Spurs. There was David Luiz, there's Oscar from Chelsea, and some of the Arsenal Brazilian players as well, Willian, etc. So but yeah, he does seem to be very much a family person, and like a very, and that's a Brazilian thing as well, the connection with your mum and family.
I mean, the comparison with Sandro is, because I mean, Sandro was such an extrovert.
Mm.
So, you know, I mean, yeah. I remember the press officer at Tottenham telling him he's at the center of everything, you know, and he's playing darts and, you know, so some people really, really enjoy the experience. Others just kind of get through it.
Mm.
And I wonder in his case, if he finds, if that's an extra difficulty. The fact of living away from home is an extra difficulty. One thing I was in the stadium for that Fulham game with one of my stepdaughters, who's obviously Brazilian, and the thing that she really picked up on, it was great seeing the whole thing from her eyes. She couldn't believe the stadium, couldn't believe it. You know, it's like wow, she just loved the whole atmosphere. It was great. And but one thing she really picked up on, you know, she doesn't speak any English, said the crowd are really on his side. You know, that the crowd are really willing him to succeed. And I thought it was really interesting that she picked up on that.
Yeah, no, I think we with the crowd, we are a good crowd. We can get on top of that. And the atmosphere at the new stadium, for me, it's still a work in progress. It's like the old White Hart Lane.
And he got nasty with Davo, didn't he? He got nasty with Davo Sanchez. I hate it when that happens.
Yeah,
that was thrown under the bus, though, that he would, you know, to be thrown in like that by Conte and then to be subbed in that game by Stellini, by Conte, it was Stellini, excuse me. You know, I was where you guys were talking now, I was thinking about Davinson Sanchez, and you know, we needed, and I say we as in the metaphorical we here, we needed a scapegoat. And I think sometimes clubs, fans do need a scapegoat, and unfortunately Sanchez was that.
There's always been one, hasn't there? It was John Pratt for years. It was Gary Stevens for a while. You know, the crowd. I mean, there are things I love about the Tottenham crowd, and I hope this still happens. But I love the fact that old players are welcome when they, unless they blotted their copybook.
Yeah, dude, they're welcome.
Yeah, obviously, and for very, very clear and obvious reasons. But you know, usually old players come back. You know, it's a warm welcome for our old friend Tony Galvin, or a game a few years ago, Peter Crouch come back with Stoke, and it was at Wembley, and I was there, and he got a big welcome. And I've always loved that. about the Tottenham crowd. I've always, I think that's a really big hearted. You have a bond with this person. All right, he's moved on. Obviously, he's moved down in the world, or he wouldn't be playing for the other side. But I've always loved that. But one thing which I've never liked is that quite a Brazilian, you know, that need to find a scapegoat in the team and blame everything on him. And I think that's historically one of the crowd's characteristics as well.
Yeah, unfortunately, that was Sanchez. I think our South American contingent this season, you know, we haven't seen enough of Gio. I'd like to have seen him a little bit more of Lo Celso. I watched a lot of him when he's at Villarreal, and I thought, we could do with him. Yeah, we could do with that guy. That kind of, he played a little bit off to the left at Villarreal. He played a bit deeper. He could join. He could go beyond their kind of like, you know, their forward player. Thought, yeah, okay, Lo Celso. You know, he, but he's never really. There were rumors, quite strong rumors, that he was a difficult character. A lot of people were saying that. You know, I don't think he's ever shown any dissent on the pitch to any of the crowd or his teammates or anything like that. So it's obviously something that happened in training. So I understand there might be a little bit of history with him and the club there, but obviously that's just rumor. Bentancur, when you watch him, he's still not moving like anywhere near what he was doing before the injury at Leicester he got with his knee. So I think as Vickery says there, it's probably, you're just going to write this season off for him. Emerson Royale, I love. Emerson Royale got an equaliser first game up away, Brentford this season. And then he was dropped and we never saw him again, pretty much, until in the first team. Poro came in and Poro's been great. You know, Poro, you know, couldn't defend last season. He could not defend. Now he's looking pretty secure defensively. He covers the blindside run. He covers the back post. You know, I've said ad infinitum, anybody listens to me, there is a fundamental flaw in Ange Ball, and that is the space behind the fullbacks, because the fullbacks aren't where the fullbacks should be. They're in where our number eights, our midfielder is.
That was the thing. I remember that game at Brentford. That was the thing that fascinated me. Look at where are the full. And then watching it in the stadium against Fulham, you know. Well, Doggy playing just all, wow. It is, just, you know, you're creating an extra problem but as we haven't cracked how to sneak 13 on the field and the referee doesn't notice, if your fullbacks are somewhere else, they're not fullback. You know, the amount of space that those centre-backs have to cover, with all the space behind them and out wide.
You said it earlier, Tim, it's the Romero being front foot, he knows the back door is closed. He knows he's got cover behind him in an absolute rapid machine. Okay, yeah. Isak ran away from him against Newcastle. Newcastle's an aberration. But when you can go in and try and win the ball, and if you don't, gets past you, you've got Mickey van der Ven who can cover behind you. It just makes it makes defending for Romero. As one of our South American players, I've been really impressed by Romero this season. I think he's reined it in. He's now joint vice captain. If Son goes off, it's either him or Maddison. I think Maddison sometimes goes off quite a bit. So Romero ends up having the armband for 15, 20 minutes in a game. And I think he's matured a lot. I think he's matured. There have been times when he's been kind of like, they've tried to like get at him. They've tried to like wind him up. They've tried to kind of like, as he's walked past, throw the shoulder into him as well. They're whispering to him. They're walking. You see all this at the stadium. You might not see it on TV. And he's not responded to it. Sometimes he's made mistakes, you know, and obviously he's going to do that. It's a high wire act defending for Spurs under Ange Ball, but yeah, Romero's. I think he's been excellent. I think he's really grown into his role, really, really, really well this season. And then Richie. Yeah, we knew he was injured. He got his pelvis fixed. He came back. He scored a lot of goals. He proved a lot of doubters wrong, and I include myself as Brendan knows, as a doubter. I was saying all last season he's not his crap in build up. He hasn't acted anything, but as a finisher in the box, which Ange needs, because the number nine in build up doesn't really touch the ball much in Ange Ball in build up. He's more of a like penalty box width kind of finisher, and you know Richie's done that. Unfortunately, he's had another knee issue. Let's hope that's behind him. He can hit the end of the season running. He can hit the ground running for the end of the season. But our South American contingent this season have been great. It'd have been nice to, as I said, more of Lo Celso, but that's
particularly with Lo Celso in the fact that Maddison's not really been doing it since he's come back from injury. So I would have hoped that because they do play similar positions that we'd at least see a bit more of Gio. Anyway, Tim, I don't know if you've noticed that our recruitment has steadily improved recently, and we brought in new people. Daniel Levy is sort of stepping further away and delegating to people like Scott Munn, and we do have a more data-led approach to recruitment. That being said, the eye test, who in South America should we be looking at? Seb Short, who you may remember, he was on the pod with you a couple of times. He asked if, let me find it, is it Andre from
Fluminense. Yeah, just picked up a knee injury, so he's going to be out for 6 weeks or so.
Definitely get him in then.
A central midfielder who would fit in, I think, because for Fluminense they play out from the back almost suicidally, and quite often he goes and plays centre back second half just to play him out. So he's receiving the ball in situations where you cannot lose it. I like him very much, but as I say, he just picked up a knee injury. The way that the market has gone, and the big European clubs are taking him when they're 18.
Yeah,
we've just had this week the South American Champions League. We've had lots of teenagers. Endrick, for example, 17, scored at Wembley. He scored one for Palmeiras. 16-year-old Kendry Paez of Ecuador, who's already scoring in World Cup qualification, he scored as well. He scored a cracker. Yeah, he's terrific. Terrific talent. But Endrick's already going to Real Madrid.
Mm.
And Kendry Paez in a year's time is going to Chelsea. No, so that's how quickly the market is getting them. There was a 16-year-old called Mastro Antonio, who scored the winner for River Plate in midweek, who's left-footed, plays wide right in a kind of 4-2-3-1, and he's beautifully poised. And he scored it off his wrong foot, and his choice of options, he's not expressive pace, but he's a footballer. He's 16. Come 18, he ain't going to be there no more. At 18, someone's going to be buying Mastro Antonio. He looks very, very good indeed. So many of the talents have already gone. And it's a big surprise to me that Andrea Fluminense is still here. And Liverpool nearly bought him last year. And for some reason, we're no longer interested in it in the last window. I didn't really understand it. So one place to look is I haven't seen much of him because he played 10 games, I think, in South America before he moved. 10 games. He's an Ecuadorian centre-back called Joel Ordóñez, who plays for Bruges, who are still involved in the European... I can't remember which one of the European things it is, but Bruges are still in the semi-finals. And he's a centre-back who's physical and classy. I remember seeing him and thinking, wow. I saw his second game and look at that. That's interesting. And I haven't seen a lot of him for Bruges. I've just seen one or two games, but he's progressing well with them. And to play our way at centre back, you've got to be good. Yeah, you've got to be quick and you've got to be good. Mm-hmm. And so he's one who may be worth a look. But I didn't know Van der Ven when they bought him. it's off my radar. So anyone who's seeing Van der Ven and buying him, they're all right with me.
Can I just ask a quick question there? You guys are over there. Whenever I see South American players come to European football or the Premier League, I watch a lot of Premier League, and I need to watch more European football. I'm getting there. These kids come over at such a young age, and they play with zero fear. Hendrick, when he came on at England, and he just went straight up against was it Stones, I think it was, or it might be Maguire, and just like literally like, okay, I might be like, this little kind of 70, but I'm still going to like show you that I deserve to be here. Is that something? I know they come from a different socio and economic background out there, but why is that? Sandro, for example, he came over and he did have any fear. We spoke to him at our social And you chatted to him, and he talks about his background. He came over. There's a little bit of doubt that we find out now. But when you see him play, you thought, this guy's got no doubt. This guy's absolutely just going to back himself. And I see that a lot with South American players.
It's a hard school, you know. It's a really, really hard school, right. You know. So okay. the ones who've come through it, they've come through one of the best filters in the world. But it doesn't work for all of them, you know. That thing of living abroad at such an early age, you know. I mean, footballers, 18-year-old footballers tend to be much younger than normal 18-year-olds. Mm-hmm. Because you know, those years in your teens, when you're out doing stupid stuff, the kind of stuff that can get you in trouble but can mature you, they've got to focus on their football, you know, because they've got to get through that filter. And quite often, the youth development people say that the big problem here is when they sign the first big contract, because suddenly, you know, sweetie shop time, you know, and that they might move house, and you don't know what's in their fridge. And so quite a few of them get lost at that point. And one of the things that's happening with Brazil now, with Brazilian football, and it loses its promises at the age of 18, you know, they go. But the big clubs, they've got the money to buy back. And they buy back from Europe. They buy back two kinds of players. They buy back the veterans who are at the end of their career and looking to run it down. But they also buy the ones who've gone to Europe and haven't come off. That's really big. You know, the good players who, for whatever reason, haven't made the grade in Europe. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't work for all of them. And it's not going to work for all of them because, and essentially what the European clubs are doing now is a futures market. You know, they're buying on promise rather than on reality. So obviously, that's not going to work. There are going to be cases. On Real Madrid, for example, Vinicius Junior, and when they bought him at 16, they couldn't have him until he was 18. When they bought him at 16, you're thinking, this is madness. It's turned out to be a huge bargain.
Mm.
But they also bought a fella called Renier from Flamengo. What's happened to him? You know, he was a massive hope, different type of player. Mm. Not quite as quick. What's happened to him? He's one who they're not going to make their investment back on, you know, and that's the way that it works. I do worry about them moving so early.
Mm.
Do worry about it. I can see in footballing terms, I can see the benefits. You want to get them adapted on the field to a quicker type of football as soon as possible, but from the point of view of the human being, that can be very difficult because some of them can just be out of their depth.
Just on an anecdotal sort of level for me, coming in, I moved to Brazil 2006, so 18 years playing football. So we were playing against some of the kids, and they were kids. They were playing barefoot. I was wearing my trainers and stuff, and the conditioning, they were like, it was almost as if playing barefoot was a benefit. It was insane. It was insane how just how strong they were in that part of their body, how their ankles wouldn't roll. They would go into challenges. The conditioning.
Smash him. Just smash him. Give him a tackle. Just say, give him a reducer.
Well, we go for an hour now. Thank you so much for joining, Tim. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you again, mate.
Cheers, my pleasure. And we're going to need it.
Against the Goons.
Because on Sunday, it reminds me so much. Reminds me so much of 71. Reminds me so much of 71, you know.
What was
last league game of the season. We've won the derby 10 years earlier, right? The double is considered impossible, right? So we've won the double 10 years earlier. It's considered impossible then, you know. And 10 years later, a very different Arsenal side from the one that we won the double with, they can win the double. On Saturday, they got the FA Cup final against Liverpool. But on Monday, they're at White Hart Lane.
Oh,
and it wasn't goal difference then. It was goal average, right? So really bizarre, right? Yeah, yeah. So Arsenal win the league if they beat us or if they draw 0-0. If they draw 1-1, they don't win the league because it's goal average.
It's average.
And not goal difference.
I remember this.
So this is a night at White Hart Lane. It's the Monday night. And obviously everyone is there because all of Tottenham, the only objective is stopping the Arsenal from winning the double. It's the only objective. And so, you know, that old white line had way more than 50,000 people in there. And another 100,000 people locked outside. You know, just absolute fucking chaos in the streets because it was huge. It's huge because we got to stop them doing the double. And right towards the end of the game, I think it's Ray Kennedy scores with a header. And at 1-0 to the Arsenal. And he said afterwards he regretted doing it because Tottenham were then even more furious. And the last few minutes is Arsenal desperately hanging on. And as I've said, if it was 0-0, Arsenal win the league. If it's 1-1, they don't. So, you know, Ray Kennedy scoring and Tottenham provoked into a reaction almost makes it worse for Arsenal. But they hang on. Oof. They win 1-0. And then the Saturday later, Charlie George scores the winner and lies on the field. And they beat Liverpool 2-1 and they win the double. So Sunday reminds me, obviously they're not going to win a double this time. But Sunday reminds me horribly of 1971.
All right, let's wrap this up. Gentlemen, thank you so much. It has been a joy of a night chatting with you guys.
Enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Cheers. My pleasure.
Up the Spurs.
Come on, you Spurs.
Come on, you Spurs.
Sports Social Podcast Network.